With unlimited time on your hands, you wouldn't need to value anything. We attach value to goods and services because of the scarcity of human time. Your time is not only your most precious possession, but the only thing you can truly own. Inflation and Cantillon effect, and the fact that even though it sounds counterintuitive and counterproductive, which effectively it is, for those that do it, it's not counterproductive at all. They are exactly the ones that benefit from it. And apparently, technology and progress, advancements, are deflationary. So if you remember... Hello and welcome to WS Podcast. My name is Wojciech Salski. I'll be your host for today. And before we begin, may I just remind you, and this is one of the first episodes that will be fully set up on the new platform. So may I just remind you to click the follow button, subscribe on whichever platform you're listening to. But I would encourage you, and I'll prepare a little advertisement for it for the upcoming episodes at some point. I would encourage you to check out Fountain. So I'll put the link below into the show to find it as the app. And I would encourage you to engage with it. It's an amazing, amazing place. It's basically like Spotify, but different. And I've decided to move my show onto Fountain. And so if you'd like to support the podcast more, if you'd like to maybe join a community there and be able to directly message me, this is all in the works. It's going to be done by the time this episode shows up in your feed. So please, please, please check out the link below and join Fountain FM. It's a wonderful space and I'm hoping that I can see you there. Other than that, if you'd like to support the podcast in any other way, please follow the links below and there are options there. And for all of you who are reaching out to me, sending me some comments, also reaching out in terms of recording a show or suggesting a book, thank you so much. It means the world to me. There are many episodes coming up with people willing to talk or people that I reached out to that decided that they are willing to talk. So look out for those. There will be more and more episodes these days with guests. So I'm really excited about it and I hope that you are too. Now, in terms of the episode of today, I'd like to share with you one of the free books which I'll explore in the coming weeks of the gentleman Knut Svanholm. And this one is called Bitcoin, Everything Divided by 21 Million. Yeah, that's the title. So, this is a book that really, really took me on a ride, on a wild one. And, you know, if you remember, and if you've explored any of my previous episodes, you know that the topic of finance and Bitcoin in particular is not completely alien to me. So I didn't expect to be so pleasantly, really, surprised by a Bitcoin-focused book as I did with this one. So yeah, I've prepared a little episode for you. And this might just be the biggest recommendation of this year. I don't know. It's always difficult because I read a lot and I read a lot of really great books. But this one definitely is one of my favorites. I literally got so excited about it that I bought a bunch of other copies and I'm planning to just be gifting them to people, also to people that might come to present themselves to us on the show into the future. So it's really something. It's really incredible, really. And so I'll stop saying really and incredible and dive right in, right? So today, in terms of the topics that I'd like to explore with you, I would start with something that will tie together a bunch of the episodes we've done before. So if you remember, the first episode of this season was about Jeff Booth's book, The Price of Tomorrow. And Jeff, if you've noticed, has written the foreword for this book, which it comes as a pleasant surprise, of course. And the first and foremost of the topics I'd like to explore with you is this idea of abundance versus scarcity. We need to get on the same page before I dive deeper into the concepts from the book. And also, I think if there is anything at all you should get away from this episode, I'd like this to be the case, that you understand the idea of scarcity and how it affects something being of value or not. And essentially, you know, when we talk about money, why scarcity matters and why abundance versus scarcity is such a huge has such a huge impact. So if you remember from The Price of Tomorrow episode from the book by Jeff Booth, apparently technology and progress, advancements, are deflationary. So if you remember, inflation is when a supply of something grows, and deflation is when the supply of something sort of diminishes. But of course, in terms of prices, for example, the prices that you experience as a consumer, when we talk about inflation in terms of finance, we talk about the increase in money supply, which means that for the same amount of money, for the same number of coins, let's say, that you have in your pocket, you can effectively buy less, because the increased supply diluted the value of each of those coins, right? So if you want to refer to inflation as a theme, and we'll sort of touch on it a little bit this episode, but we've made a much bigger dive, a much deeper dive into it in the previous ones. I'll link below The Price of Tomorrow, The New Confessions of Economic Hitman, and also Why You Shouldn't Buy Bitcoin. These are the episodes that I would suggest for you to start with to understand. And I'll also link below a few other episodes that I think should be of value to you. Now, the first sort of quote I'd like to bring up is this one, just for you to think about and for me to explore. Abundance in money equals scarcity in everything else. And conversely, scarcity in money equals abundance everywhere else. For the purpose of this episode, and for the purpose of your understanding of what I'm trying to explore here, you need to understand that if the supply of money increases, and therefore whatever you have in your pocket loses value, then the price of whatever you're willing to purchase for that money will go up, right? Relatively. If there are 10 apples on the table and you had £10 in your pocket, or $10, and by the time you're asking the salesman what is he willing to, you know, to take for buying all these 10 apples, if this is the price, then one apple would probably be worth £1, right? That this is a very simplified explanation. Now, imagine that suddenly both of you realize through price signaling, because price effectively is a signal of how much something is worth in the denomination of the other. If you realize that there is much more money available, and therefore suddenly your £10 are no longer worth £10 from yesterday, but now they are worth an equivalent of £5 from yesterday, it is likely that the salesperson will ask for £2 per apple, because there was no increase in supply of apples. There are still 10 apples on the table, but there was an increase in supply of money, and therefore apples became more scarce in comparison to money, which became more abundant. And this quote here says exactly that. Abundance in money equals scarcity in everything else. And conversely, scarcity in money equals abundance everywhere else. So You can buy more with less only if your money is scarce, right? If you come to someone and you ask to pay in sand, it is unlikely that you will get much for your kilogram of sand because there is plenty of sand to go around. It's very difficult, therefore, to be making money selling sand at the same time. It's very specialized, and I guess some companies do it, but effectively, why we've not chosen sand to be our monetary token is because there is plenty of it. There is an abundance of it, and therefore it would not be effective. And so over the centuries, over millennia, humanity, and I bet any other creature out there who are on as sophisticated level as we are in terms of our sort of cooperation and trade, figured out that the more scarce something is, the better it is at prevailing, sort of maintaining value. But then, as you remember from the previous episodes, it's not good enough for something to be finitely scarce if it's not divisible. Because if you have a Picasso painting, yes, of course, that's a very scarce thing to have, especially if it's the original and it's the only one there. But at the same time, good luck trying to pay for something with half of that painting, right? It simply is not divisible. And therefore, at some point in the history of mankind, it turns out that gold and silver, as metals that are easily divisible, started being used for monetary policies, right? For using it as a currency, effectively. Now, as money. Now, the one thing that I wanted to mention here in terms of the inflation, and something that we sort of touched a little bit when we talked about the New Confessions of Economic Hitman, is the idea of Cantillon effect. Because you could say, but wait, isn't it that inflation is negatively impacting the value of money, and therefore those that are causing inflation are losing? Why would they do it, right? Why would you dilute a supply of something that you hold as well, right? It sounds counterintuitive. You wouldn't cut the branch of a tree you're sitting on, right? It's not something we would do instinctively. And that's a good question. And the answer is the Cantillon effect, which is named after Richard Cantillon, who was an Irish gentleman, who first noticed the phenomenon. And basically, the phenomenon is what central banking does. It's, as Knut writes, successful alchemy. The money-issuing institutions of the world have found a way to create new money with no cost. The central bank's promise of stable prices is as absurd as the alchemist's promise of cheap gold. The whole point of value measurement tool or a type of money lies in its costliness. Money created without cost is like fool's gold. It enriches the issuer and his friends, while everyone else pays for the whole ordeal. The further away you are from the money printer, the more you pay for the counterfeiting. So even though us both standing around the table, me trying to buy the apples and the salesperson trying to sell those apples, even though our savings are diluted and we're the ones losing when inflation happens, those that print the money, those that decide to increase the supply of money, don't lose as much because they effectively use the printed money, quickly purchasing whatever they wish to purchase. And since they didn't do any work other than clicking a button to obtain that money, it's effectively free money, right? It's obviously not free because they've stolen it from everyone else who held money by simply diluting their reserves, their savings. Okay, so to establish these this imbalance, let's say, in terms of abundance and scarcity, remember, for the sake of the argument and for the sake of yours, really, that the more scarce something is, the more stable it potentially can be at keeping its value. But the moment someone can make more of it, and easily, and worse even, someone can make loads of it for free, it's no longer scarce, it becomes abundant, and therefore falls in price. You know, the air we breathe is obviously something we really need. And so if you are underwater and you're starting to choke, you're probably be willing to give up anything for a breath of fresh air. But when you're walking around, you know, in the woods on an average day, if you find someone who's telling you that they are selling air in, you know, in containers on whatnot, you're probably just think that they're crazy, because there is an abundance of it around you. You don't need much air bought in a jug or in a plastic bag if there is an abundance of it. Only when it becomes scarce does it become valuable, and extremely so at times. Similar with water, you know, a good example of this is how much do you pay for a bottle of water in your shop, you know, and down the road? How much would you pay for a bottle of water in the middle of a desert where there is no water anywhere and you're really thirsty? You're probably much more likely to overpay effectively for water in the desert than you are when you're, walking down the street and you just fancy some water. So just remember, inflation and Cantillon effect, and the fact that even though it sounds counterintuitive and counterproductive, which effectively it is, for those that do it, it's not counterproductive at all. They are exactly the ones that benefit from it. And of course, here we come to the second point, which is that inflation is a time thief. Now, why time? I loved this part of the book so much that I even read it to my wife at some point. Let's see. We are here. Okay. Okay, yeah, this is a wonderful passage, and I'll actually read it, and it's quite a long one, but I think you're going to appreciate it greatly. Your wealth is the sum total of your efforts and expenditures, and you are the sum total of your experiences. Your mind evolved over millennia to fit into a group, so naturally, you compare your life to the lives of others. The longer you live, the more unique your personal journey becomes, the more unique skill sets you acquire, and the more valuable you become to others. The basic principles of the free market are still present everywhere. The division of labor works in your favor. Regardless of what political system you live in, your uniqueness determines your value to others. Originality, or scarcity, is crucial to how valuable something is. Availability and demand determine the prices of everything. make sure you're in short supply. You decide the value of your time. No one else can do it for you. When more than one mind craves something, that thing generates a price. But whether that price is worth paying or not is for the buyer to decide. Scarce things are costly, and nothing in the world has a more limited supply than your time on this earth. It diminishes with every tick of the clock. Your time on this planet becomes even more limited with every word of this book you read. Even right now, and I'll come back in a second exactly to the same page because I have a second piece here to share with you. Time is all you have, right? At the foundational, the most essential level of your being, the way we perceive reality, unless something changes in the coming decades, that, you know, maybe we discover something that renders the perception of time irrelevant. You and me, and probably everyone you know, perceives the reality we live in this space-time fashion, right? You could portray it maybe like a movie, or maybe like an arrow going in one direction. There seems to be a never-ending now, which will end at some point, and there is no going back, right? Every word I say, every breath I take is there and it's gone. It's not going to come back. You cannot rewind time, or at least we don't know how to just yet. And why is it important? Why is it relevant here, you know, to talk about such an philosophical, abstract, yet so essential to each of us concept? It's because money, in many ways, is energy. It's a tool. This is how I tried to portray it to my father when we had a discussion lately. It's a tool that allows us to sort of exert energy, send it into the future, to maintain it, to keep it in some ways, right? If you're saving, you're saving from spending it now into the future. It's impossible to save your time now into the future, which is funny that we sometimes say, I'd like to save some time, so I'll do X, Y, Z, because effectively, you know, there is no time to save. You're living, and at some point, that's that. And, you know, there is no second tomorrow, and there is no second today. It just is. But in terms of energy, money allows us to send energy into the future. We can earn through our efforts and our time, you know, probably like many of you out there, probably you, my dear listener, as well, and certainly me at this time in my life. I have a job, I go to that job, I spend some time and effort within the confines of whatever I'm expected to do, and I get in exchange some money for it, right? And that money is a somewhat of an equivalent of that energy I've expressed, I guess, given away. And now, with the money I have, I can use it to pay for other efforts of someone else, right? I don't need to bake my own bread. I can go to the shop and get the bread from the baker. He expensed his energy and effort and time to bake the bread. And in exchange for my money, he will be able to pay the electrician, who will exert his energy and time to fix the light bulb at his house, right? And so you can think of money as a vehicle for sending energy into the future. That's when it becomes a saving as well as investing mechanism. It allows us to basically over time, if it's good money, sound money, and for that, you know, we'll explore it later, but if you've seen a few of these episodes or you've read any of the books I've suggested so far, you understand the concept of sound money. The more sound the money it is, the more likely it is to be able to facilitate whatever you want into the future without losing its value. And this is where inflation becomes your time thief. Because if you think about it, if I've spent an X amount of hours to earn a Y amount of dollars, and then by the time I get to spend these dollars, because of inflation, these dollars are worth 20% less. What effectively happened is that inflation of 20% taken away my time that I've already exerted. That's the time thief there. It's not exactly, because it's sort of one step away, but effectively it is, right? Because for the same amount of time, if inflation was not the case, I would be able to enjoy a full 100% of that earned energy. But because of inflation, only 80% of that energy is for me to use going forward. And with time, it takes more time. And with time, it takes more time to earn the same amount because inflation happens. And with time, the longer I wait before I spend, the less I have effectively to spend. And this is a tragic outcome because it promotes spending in the present and not saving and investing into the future. And I think this is exactly what you're experiencing in your life on the daily. You know, if you live in a country where there is hyperinflation, where the prices are going up so quickly, so radically day after day, you know how it is to go into the shop today and buy anything you can today, because you know by this time tomorrow, your money will be worth half the price. And so you might as well spend it all today, because otherwise you're going to lose half of the value of it by tomorrow. And of course, if you're experiencing inflation on smaller scale, it might not hurt that much, and we'll come back to this point. But the point here is inflation becomes a time thief. And now the second part of this incredible chapter. The second law of thermodynamics describes the irreversibility of natural processes. Increased entropy is the very thing that distinguishes the future from the past. In other words, entropy gives the unforgiving arrow of time its direction. In this sense, Bitcoin adoption functions as a shield against entropy. Now, try to imagine, and I did it with my wife, so you enjoy this part. Try to imagine how much time you have left on this planet. Try to make a rough estimate. You have a lot of seconds left, but not that many years. Your focus during those seconds will determine the outcome of those years to a large extent. Choose wisely how you spend your days. They are not coming back. Think, error correct, enjoy. The time you have on this planet is scarce. So is the total number of satoshis that will ever exist. Those are the small units of measure in Bitcoin. Every tool that mankind ever invented saves someone time somewhere. That's the ultimate purpose of tools and technologies. Time saving is progress. We emancipate ourselves from the drudgery of whatever hamster's wheel we're in by freeing up time. If you own Bitcoin, you can afford to be patient. Most people have no idea how powerful this is, but they will learn. We value things because of how much time we predict those things can save us. You can either kill your time or let someone else waste it. If you own your time, you get the privilege of killing it. If you let others decide what to do with your time, you allow others to waste your time. And, you know, here an important thing to maybe note is, if you think about it, in many ways, distractions are exactly what takes away your time as well, right? You can distract yourself with your own choices, or you can allow whatever is out there to distract you. Even this podcast might be a distraction for you from something. And so I would encourage you to be more mindful about this. And when I was reading this and when I was discussing it with my wife, it dawned on me how real it is and yet how little we think about it. Now, I've read till the end, so you saw that this idea that, you know, those who have Bitcoin can wait, they have the patience, and it actually works to the betterment of their situation. And I would like to ask you now, before I explain, do you understand why? Based on what has been said in this episode so far, do you understand why by holding value in something that is scarce, that is finite, that you know that there is a limit to it and no one can print more of it, why is it that by keeping your energy in it, you save more time, you have more time than those that keep their energy, their money in other things that can be inflated? Well, of course, you're correct. It's because if something cannot be inflated, it doesn't waste time. And especially if other things are being inflated, bring back the quote from the beginning of the book, that when everything else becomes abundant and your money is scarce, effectively everything else costs less. The deflation is what you're experiencing. The prices are actually falling. And I've already encouraged you in the previous episode, but I'll link below for you to explore this. I'll link below one of the pages that shows prices of housing, prices of goods, prices of technology, prices of other assets priced in Bitcoin as a unit of measure. And you can see what deflation means, even though we are in many ways living through times that prices are going up and everyone experiencing inflation. If you measure things in Bitcoin, you'll notice that prices are actually falling down quite precipitously, quite quickly and drastically. So I'll just write down for you to put that link here as well. Okay, now, as we've talked a little bit about time, let's finish with this one. Let's finish with a bang. Another way to look at time is to consider it the only natural resource worth anything. Now, imagine that you knew that you would live forever, that you were both immortal and indestructible. In this hypothetical case, you wouldn't need to act, ever. You could always wait until tomorrow and postpone everything indefinitely forever. In such a reality, nothing would be of value to you. With unlimited time on your hands, you wouldn't need to value anything. We attach value to goods and services because of the scarcity of human time. Your time is not only your most precious possession, but the only thing you can truly own. Do you understand? Did that just break your brain? If we were living forever, there would always be tomorrow. And if there would always be tomorrow, there would be no value in doing anything today. You could potentially be just constantly waiting for tomorrow. And it would be much more difficult for anyone to sell you anything of value to your present self, right? because you would always be ready to just wait till tomorrow, because maybe they're gonna take the price a bit down. Now, in terms of the next topic I wanted to explore with you is this saving, right? We've already explored that inflation is a time thief. Inflation is the thief of energy, effectively. And if you notice, unless your wage rises equivalently to your to the actual real inflation, you're effectively chasing, and you will never catch it in the system we are living in, you're effectively chasing your own tail, trying to work harder and longer to make the same amount of money in value terms, even though over time that money loses value, and therefore you need to work more and more to get the same outcome. And this is the tragedy of saving. You know, if you remember Rich Dad Poor Dad episode, which was one of the first episodes we've ever done on the financial nature, Robert Kiyosaki is known for saying that savers are losers. And of course it sounds quite, you know, quite rough to say it, quite straightforward really, but in many ways it is true, because if you are keeping your energy, your money in a currency, in some fiat currency that is being inflated, you are losing. If you're not putting it into assets that will appreciate in price in comparison to, you know, in relation to that currency, you're effectively losing. Of course, if you know the basics surrounding Bitcoin and gold, you'll understand as well that things such as houses and prices of, you know, houses of or land or anything rarely actually appreciate in value unless the thing that you're measuring them in is broken. And our money is broken. The way we live right now in many ways is broken in terms of our finance. And this is something that is becoming more and more prevalent and noticed by people. It simply might not have touched you just yet, because maybe you've not thought about it before. For many reasons, it's not advertised, right? We're not taught this in schools, because schools are funded by the same people that that print the money. So why would they tell you their shtick, right? Now, let's see how saving becomes actually possible with Bitcoin. What we live in today is a world based on consumerism, wasteful spending at the expense of future generations. No wonder we have environmental problems. Production and transportation costs are lower than ever, and the price vectors all point in the same direction: zero marginal costs. But fiat money already has a zero marginal cost, and today's high prices are artificial. They are not real. The only thing that can give you a hint of how cheap everything has become is Bitcoin. Its ever-increasing purchasing power is a testament to how fooled we've been. Denominated in Bitcoin, all prices fall, as they should. The production of more junk is of almost no cost to the producers of that junk. It's costly to the consumer, but not as expensive as not spending your money at all. Everything has an opportunity cost. There's always a choice. In a Bitcoin-denominated world, we can all access the riches of the abundant future. Bitcoin reduces wastefulness and increases truthfulness. It emits freedom dioxide, expanding all of our freedom footprints. All we have to do is alter our time horizon. With Bitcoin, we can all get everything we want by saving money. It's that simple. But the most beautiful side effect of the system is that we'll stop over-consuming. Bitcoin's dilution-proof technology ensures that everyone stays disincentivized to spend. No one wants to let go of a monetary good that goes up in value over time. Everyone will be more careful with their money. This is what the world needs and what everyone in it needs personally too. Think about it. This is huge. The moment we no longer are driven to spend here and now because of the fear that tomorrow we won't be able to afford as much as today, is the moment we stop over-consuming and we stop trashing this place in so many ways. You know, you can argue whether or not and what are the reasons for all kinds of pollution in this world and all kinds of bad food, junk and everything we use. But if you notice and you notice correctly, the longer we stay in a system in which with every day you spend, your money is worth less, and so you need to run a little bit faster or you need to produce a little bit cheaper, effectively producing worse and worse to cut your costs. As long as we keep going down this direction, we will be getting more and more of the junk and more of pollution, right? Because the system as it is right now incentivizes waste, incentivizes consumption, and disincentivizes saving, because savers are losers. But the moment you save in something that no one can print more of, no one can dilute, as you know, its value will not be diluted, its supply will not be increased by a push of a button, is the moment you stop running faster with each day to chase, you can actually slowly but surely slow down, start walking, and then potentially at some point even stand and just observe. And this is why so many people that joined the Bitcoin movement, I guess, I don't know if you could call it a movement, the moment they have more time on their hands, they actually reflect on the world and start doing much more meaningful and much deeper things. And this is what, for example, apparently has been taking place in Renaissance, right? If you remember the great artists that we know so much about, they usually had some sponsors, some patrons that would pay for their expenses so they wouldn't have to worry about chasing money. And so they could spend all that time creating these beautiful things. Now ask yourself, why there is so little great artists popping up these days, even though it's rather impossible for people to be less, you know, skilled than they were before? Well, of course, it's the case that everyone is so broke and everyone's so struggling to make their ends meet that they don't have any time about figuring out how to paint the new Mona Lisa. This is the point. Bitcoin gives you back your time. It allows you to over time save and over time slow down with your actions and effectively renders this chase that you're experiencing with every paycheck you make obsolete. Now, yeah, I think at this point I'm gonna mention this to you. Just because you don't feel the pain that much of inflation, maybe you are in a later stage of your life, like my father, and you've grown used to this. You don't think it's actually that big of a deal that there is inflation happening. Maybe you know from your classes of economics that actually inflation is something that should happen because it expands the market and whatever they told you. That's all fair and square. It's up to you. It's completely your experience. And I don't want to take away from it. I'll just share with you what I've discussed with my father lately. We talked about this and he was very adamant that this is not a problem, that inflation is not actually that problematic, and that at least for him, in his position, it's not something he worries about, and he doesn't see it as an issue he wants to explore. And ask yourself, does it bother you? And if it doesn't, then well done, because if you thought it through and it doesn't bother you, then you're among the few privileged that are living in such an abundance and on such a level that this little drip of blood from your belly does not hurt you that much, right? It's like a bruise. You can have a tiny bruise on your arm and you will not notice it much. It might hurt from time to time, but you can live with it. It would be very different if you had a broken arm, right? In the same way, if you are living in a country where inflation is on such a level that it just about does not touch you on the daily and you don't notice it as painfully, and you're among the people that don't notice it, you know, on the daily, you can get away with it. It's like boiling the frog, right? There is this sort of parable or a story or image that the way to boil a frog alive is to slowly increase the temperature in which the frog is sat, you know, put the frog into a pot and slowly increase its temperature. Of course, what happens there is the frog doesn't recognize the change in temperature, and the moment it recognizes it, it's too late, it's already cooked. In a similar way, if you don't notice this energy being siphoned from you through dilution of your savings, you might not notice it now, but you will notice it retrospectively. And it's just something worth considering, at least worth understanding. And I fully appreciate that once you've understood it and you still don't want to explore it further, that's up to you, and that's completely fine. And that's where we finished our conversation as well with my father. It simply is not something that he's interested in. Now, our last part, and I can see that we've been talking for quite some time now, is about violence. Let's talk about violence. Now, let's read some quotes here. A slave is a person that another person treats as their property. People usually became enslaved because someone forced them to. Slavery is rarely a voluntary state of being, nor is it an either-or. Viewed through a libertarian lens, almost everyone is at least partially enslaved. In theory, taxes are giving something back to society at large, but you do not get to decide how much state allocates of your how the state allocates your confiscated resources. Viewed through this lens, you would be X percent enslaved, right? Wrong. Your income tax is not the only tax you're paying. You give away a specific part of your time and effort when you pay taxes. So now this is a little calculation that I'd like you to explore. And we'll talk about coercion in a second. If you consider that when you give away money for taxes, you do it not because you've agreed to do it, but because you have no other choice, and, you know, I don't advise it, but of course you can try not paying for some time and seeing how it turns out. You'll be pretty unpleasantly surprised when someone shows up at your door and asks for you to pay. But Knut here asks us to explore as well in what other ways do we pay from our earnings. And if you consider it, corporate taxes, capital gains taxes, social security contributions, etc. They have to get this money from somewhere. So chances are high that you're indirectly paying for their taxes also, through increased prices and fees, at least a part of them. If you live in an interventionist society, you're paying extra taxes every time you buy a good or a service, value-added taxes, sales taxes, import tariffs, environmental taxes, all the taxes paid during the manufacture and transportation of the goods you're buying, They all add to your total enslavement rate. But it doesn't end there either. We have to include inflation, the tax that funnels wealth from the begging hands of the have-nots into the iron fists of the have-it-alls. The thing is, and this is really the crux of the matter, the poor always end up paying for inflation. The proportion of the poor's total wealth held in cash is very high compared to the wealthy who own assets that appreciate over time. So, you know, when you when you are for bigger taxes, what effectively happens is that it's the poor that will be taxed the most and the middle class. The rich usually can find ways of not paying taxes because they hold their money in assets. They know it because they've been educated about how to store their value. But why am I reading this? Why am I reading about taxes? Why am I reading about slavery when I was supposed to talk about violence now? Now, if you remember from the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, violence, and this is something also that the Bitcoin standard greatly explores. Violence is essentially an act of either, you know, expropriating someone from something, of something, or, you know, inflicting pain or some sort of negative stuff on another. And what happens in a nation state is that through participating in it, you are a subject to a system that, of course, has the monopoly for violence as well as has the monopoly for money. It can, you know, the central bank has a monopoly on printing money and the state has a monopoly of violence. It basically means that there is this, you know, imagine if we're all in a sandbox as kids. Imagine that there was an adult standing around making sure that we are all playing by the rules. But that adult standing and watching us play, they don't play by the same rules, right? They are the ones setting up the rules. And of course, we can participate in it to a degree. We can sort of vote for a certain representation and whatnot. But for the most part, if the state decides to do something, they have the monopoly on violence to do so. And therefore, they have the monopoly of asking you to do something. And if you don't do it, they can make you do it regardless. And this is the problem and somewhat troubling invitation Knut offers us in his book about recognizing how enslaved you are, depending on what country you live in and depending on the level of taxation you are paying every month, every year, you can consider that to be your enslavement rate, right? So, for example, if your income tax is 20%, and then your VAT tax is another 20% of whatever you buy, and then you pay a bunch of other council tax and local and insurance, you know, and whatever, the different taxes for social security and maybe some waste disposal tax and whatever else, capital gains tax, you might just find that 50% of your monthly influx of energy that you've earned through your labor is being siphoned off for all those things. And of course, it's all well and good if it works for the betterment of society, and this is not the place for us to discuss whether or not it is, but it's worth considering and recognizing that that might just be the case. And of course, after all of these, you need to add inflation as a tax that is hidden, but that takes place on the daily, especially if you keep your money in cash, in savings, in the currency that is being inflated. So now let's find the last little quote from the book. which is about the slavery redefined. If we define slavery as the percentage of our labor that we give up, we are all enslaved to the government to some extent. You might argue that this is not wholly a bad thing, since the physical well-being of the enslaved person is a priority of its owner. Thus, the state must allow its subjects to keep some of their earnings to keep them alive. Think again. Controlling the masses can be very cheap. The less they have, the easier they are to manage. Universal basic income is a good indicator of how the state values its subjects. Under such a system, most people would be 100% dependent on the state for their survival. This is the end goal of such policies, regardless of how they are being advertised. People dependent on wealth redistributions are unlikely to vote against such policies. They are no longer seen as people by the state, but as zombified voting cattle. And remember, holding a state-sanctioned popularity contest every 4 years does not make theft less immoral. Violent coercion is wrong, regardless of what the majority thinks. And of course, universal basic income is not universal, not basic, and definitely not an income, because if it's coming from the state, then it had to be taken away from someone to begin with. Now, I know that some of you, if you've gotten this far, well done, and I hope you enjoyed. I know that some of you might be quite troubled by this episode and by some of the others that we've done recently. These are not easy topics, and these are not easily digestible ideas, especially if you haven't before thought about these. But personally, I believe they are worth your while. They are worth thinking about. This is not to say that you should abandon all hope or you should abandon all that you're doing, but it's worth thinking about things and thinking for yourself, right? To ask yourself whether you understand what's going on around you. And I hope that this episode yet again adds another brick to the wall of your understanding and exploration and curiosity of what the world is about and how it works and how can you find your place in it most efficiently and act most skillfully. In terms of the book, as I said, I would definitely recommend it. It's by far one of the most approachable books to read for someone who has not had a chance to explore Bitcoin, economy, idea of money before. Knut writes really, really beautifully and quite funnily at times. And it's a joy to read. I'm currently reading. I've actually finished a second book by him, and I have a third one to go through. And they are wonderful. So I'll link below the book for you, and I would encourage you to read it. Now, the invitation for this week for you, if you've gotten this far, is to educate yourself. Choose one of these ideas that we've explored, whether it's about the abundance versus scarcity, maybe it's about inflation or about the natural state of economy being deflationary, as Jeff Booth likes to say. Maybe it's about saving, maybe it's about Bitcoin, maybe it's about violence and coercion and states. Whatever you'd like to explore, consider taking 10, 15, 20 minutes of your time, maybe an hour this week. Choose one of these topics. Maybe it's just by reading this book. It's not going to take you long. It's not a big one. And educate yourself. Take time and really get out there and learn. This is what I'd like to share with you, and this is what I'd like to inspire you to do in the spirit of making yourself and your future better. I would encourage you to go forth and do just that. So, yeah, other than that, If you haven't already, please follow the link below to check out Fountain FM, where there will be an availability of joining a group chat, messaging with me directly. You can send me some information there as well. If you'd like to support the podcast in any other way, please follow the links below. There are plenty of ways to do so. If you haven't already, subscribe and like, you know, do whatever you're doing with all the other podcasts that are valuable for you. I appreciate you greatly, and I thank you for spending the time with me today. I hope this was something that will empower and inspire you. Have a wonderful, wonderful week. Stay happy, stay healthy, and I'll see you next time.